This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. With each passing year, we lose more survivors of World War II. And not just the soldiers who fought, but the targeted civilians who survived the Holocaust. They hid, they fought, and they fled. Some lost entire families. Some never saw their homes again. Today, we share a few of their stories in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day. We begin with a local organization that works to bring Holocaust stories to area youth. This is a rebroadcast from earlier this year. The Chapel Hill Durham Holocaust Speakers Bureau has brought together the many Holocaust survivors over who are still living in our area. Joining us now is Sharon Helprin. She's one of the organizers of the Bureau and the daughter of two Holocaust survivors. Sharon, welcome. Good to have you on the program.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. We've been looking forward to being here.
Well, also joining us are two Holocaust survivors, Renee Fink and Peter Stein. Renee and Peter, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter, tell us, you were just a child at the start of World War II. Where were you and what was happening to you?
Sure. I also wanted to thank you, Frank, for featuring us and talking about this important issue of genocide and the Holocaust. My parents met and married in 1934. My father was Jewish. My mother was Catholic. I was born in 1936. And in March 15th, 1939, the Germans march into Prague. Hitler spends one day in Prague Castle, and he leaves the next day. And things continued to get worse and worse. By 1942, my grandmother, my Jewish grandmother, was sent to Terezin, where she died 19 days later because her insulin was confiscated. My uncle and two aunts and their spouses were arrested and sent to Terezin and eventually to Auschwitz to die. My father, because he was married to a Christian, was doing slave labor for several years before he himself was sent to Terezin. I didn't know about this. My mother protected me and said that when I asked, where's Dad, she said he's on a business trip. He was a businessman. I knew he had to take trips. And I honestly don't know if I accepted her whole answer, but that's what I had.
You're going to school in Czechoslovakia at the time. Did the German authorities know about your father and mother? So this was a kind of an approved relationship. They knew who your father was, but you and your mother were safe, or did she have to hide that relationship?
As far as I know, she didn't hide it. I mean, he wore the yellow star on his outer garments. And periodically, he would come back home, particularly on Sundays. And so it was there. But on several occasions, we were stopped by Czech policemen. One particular instance, he had the star on his jacket, on the left side of the jacket, and he had a briefcase that partly hid it. And a Czech policeman stopped him. We were all walking downtown for ice cream. And a row ensued, and I was very scared that something would happen right there. So he was not protected. But my mother, in a way, was also a survivor because she was basically a single parent for a good part of the war.
And had to figure out a way to keep the family going, you going, and sort of what to tell you and what not to, all of these terrible decisions. I want to hear more sure. about your story, Renee, but please tell us where you were and how old you were when the war began.
Well, when the war began, first of all, I was born in 1937, and in Holland, and things became very dangerous in 1942. Up until that time, we could more or less live not as normal. There was nothing normal, but I won't go into that whole story now. But in 42, one either had to hide, go into hiding, or go to the camps. And so my parents, through the help of the Dutch underground, which is known as the Dutch resistance is known as the underground, a home was found for me, and they went into hiding separately, and my aunt and my grandmother and other family members were on the run.
hiding.
This is a large family. This is a Catholic family, apparently.
Oh, no, no. The Catholic family was my foster family. Uh-huh. That was the hiding family. Yes. Uh-huh. And my whole being lights up when I talk about them. They risked. There were 8 children, 2 parents. And I made the 9th child. So 10 people, by harboring me, hiding me, risk their lives on a daily basis to have me in their home. And I find it so remarkable when you think about the courage of others that they just did what they felt was the right thing to do without having ideas of time.
And these were not at all abstract threats. The authorities were coming into the house pretty regularly to do head counts, right?
They did. Oh. And to take whatever they wanted and to, put a great deal of fear and anxiety into our lives. And whatever we had, if they wanted it, they took it.
Sharon, you are the daughter of Holocaust survivors and also one of the organizers of this group. Tell us how you met Renee and Peter.
The Holocaust Speakers Bureau began in the fall of 2010. Debbie Long, another Chapel Hill second generation, or we call them 2G, and I were put together by our hairdresser, a common way for men and women to connect, I think. This hairdresser knew we were both children of survivors, and we decided to have a cup of coffee. We talked about our parents' experiences and the fact that survivors were getting older, more frail, losing some cognitive skills, and dying. So we decided to get our local survivors and liberators together, and we formed a speakers bureau back in 2010, and we've been going ever since. Renee and Peter are often requested by schools, organizations, museums, libraries. And,
I want to hear a little more about each of these stories as well. Peter, so there you are in Prague. You have a Catholic mother. Your father is gone. She's explaining that he's on business trips. You're 5, 6, 7 years old. You're going to school. Who's in charge? Are Czech authorities, when you go to school, for instance, are your teachers German now or are they Czech? And what are you being told in school?
Sure. Well, so Czechoslovakia is broken up into the protectorates, euphemism, of Bohemia and Moravia, and Slovakia separates. It's under a Catholic quisling, but that's a different story. We have Czech teachers in the schools, but we learn German. And there's a picture of Adolf Hitler and the German flag in front of each classroom. So we were reminded daily that the Germans were there. The Germans were in the streets. And I was one scared little boy for a good deal of the war.
How clear was it to you that you were a victim and that your father had actually become a victim of these very Nazis that you were now having to, in some way, pay homage to?
Again, I think my mother was very concerned that I not reveal my Jewish identity. And I got into a couple of fights in school with a bully. Every school has a bully. This guy called me a Jew. I said I wasn't a Jew. We got into a fight. This was the second grade. The teacher broke it up, took us down to the principal, and I don't know. I'd got settled, but I had a bloody nose out of it because he was bigger than I am. So I didn't fully understand it. I mean, I knew there were problems, but, you know, you try to survive and go on with regular activity.
Is there a kind of underground? I'm wondering what your teachers are doing, too, and what they're saying about all this. Was there a way in which you could sort of find people who could tell you the truth about what's happening with the war, or was it a kind of propaganda campaign?
Well, I have a great story about that. So Monday through Friday, we have propaganda, of course, on the radio and elsewhere, talking about the wonderful Nazi German victories in Russia and so on. On Sundays, my mother and I go to my Catholic grandparents' house, and somehow they managed to have enough meat because they had some friends who were farmers. And Sunday evening at 5 o'clock, my grandfather puts on the BBC, and the BBC, and he pulls out a map of Europe, and he identifies what's going on. And I remember distinctly being there when during the Normandy landings, D-Day invasion. And so he rolls out this whole story, and my cousin and I are very happy. But he said, whatever you do, you can't talk about this in school on Monday.
I mean, that's the man. I was just going to ask you about that. What do you do when your teachers are telling you something and you want to raise your hand and say, no, I heard on the BBC. But you don't do that.
Try to keep your hand down.
Try to keep your hand down. We're going to continue this story and talk more with Renee and Sharon, too, as our conversation continues about the survivors of the Holocaust. We're talking with Peter Stein, Renee Fink, and Sharon Halperin, who is one of the organizers of the Chapel Hill Durham Holocaust Speakers Bureau. And we're doing that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Sharon Halperin, one of the organizers of the Chapel Hill Durham Holocaust Speakers Bureau, also the daughter of two Holocaust survivors. Renee Fink is with us, Peter Stein, both survivors of the Holocaust. Renee, tell us more about your story now. You were one of now a 10-member family in Holland. Tell us a little bit about life, everyday life.
We were all very busy, and as Peter speaks about his school memories. I wasn't able to go to school because it wasn't safe. As a hidden child, there were other children who were appearing in houses and had to either be invisible or had to be somehow explained. And there was always the danger that questions would be raised. So it was unsafe for me to attend school. And I never learned to read or write. But my oldest Catholic sister's best friend was running a nursery school or kind of kindergarten. And so I somehow went part of the day to kindergarten. We didn't have pencils or papers. We didn't learn anything. But that was the extent of my schooling. Then everyday life was harsh. But we were all part of this wonderful family. There was no overt show of love, but I have never felt so accepted and so equal. And that's why you may find it so very odd that I can tell you the best years of my childhood were my war years, not to mention the 4 years I spent with my parents.
Right.
They're just very difficult to remember. But I would like people to know that when the war was over, the misery really set in for many of the survivors and very much so for the children. So our lives kind of went to pieces after that.
Well, I want to know what was happening during this time. Did you know what was happening to the rest of your family and what was happening at that time?
I actually didn't know that I was Jewish. When you think that middle-class Jewish families in Germany and Holland, we're talking about Western Europe, were much more assimilated and lived as professionals and had servants and lived the good life. So as being so assimilated, there was no overt Jewishness in any memory that I have. But once I went into hiding, I learned that I had a new name, a very nice Dutch name, and that I was a devout Catholic. And I learned all the prayers, and there was holy water on the door jamb of my bedroom, and every night before going to sleep, we all crossed ourselves. So I was a very, very good little Catholic girl.
That had to be the hard learning the liturgy and the choreography of the Catholic Church was the hardest part for me. So I understand. So, tell me more about this. So your family, is your adoptive family, the Catholic family, telling you about what's happening, or can they?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No. Knowledge was absolutely dangerous.
Right.
One person could not know what the next person was doing, especially in the resistance. We all had false names. I mean, I, as a Jew, had a false Catholic name. a false identity and religion, and we just learned the new rules. One day we were one person, and the next day we were another, and could not speak about anything.
Was it frightening for you to go abroad? You're out and just, you know, sort of riding your bicycle. Are you always conscious of the fact that something could happen?
You mean when I was in Holland?
When you, yes, yes. And
I didn't have a bicycle. The bicycle story comes from the day that my parents said goodbye to me, and I went off on the back of a stranger's bicycle to my hiding house. And I didn't know why I was on the bicycle or where we were going. I don't remember now how many hours it took. And then I found myself in a house that seemed very large, but to a four-year-old who was small, I think the world seems very large, and all the people who came into the house were big-boned, blonde, and I was tiny and dark.
Peter, Renee talks about the trouble and the pain setting in after the war. Tell us about that experience for you and when you finally started to find out what was happening or what had happened to the rest of your family.
That took a while. The dramatic piece was my dad coming back from Terezin on a Red Army truck. I was watching the street that we lived on runs from Prague to Pilsen. And the truck stops and two Red Army Russian soldiers get out and they help about 12 or 15 survivors off. So we were reunited again. This was in May 1945. In the meantime, there was civil war for about 5 days when the Czech resisted the Germans. But the story of the Holocaust took a long time to unwind. He did speak about some of the experiences. But honestly, it was not until I was after college and I convinced my father to return to Terezin on a tour. And he showed me where his mother died and the barracks he lived in, the terrible conditions, not enough food, very little food, lice, vermin, and the constant fear of being shipped east, which meant being placed on a boxcar to Auschwitz. And that was the fear. And that's when I began to realize the enormity of this tragedy.
Why was that important for you to go back there and to hear him tell his story?
Well, I felt there was a hole in the family history. I really didn't know about it. And he had what's called survivor guilt, that he was the only member of a family of nine to survive. His mother perished, everybody else. And why was he chosen? And I needed that, and much later wound up teaching courses about the Holocaust, but that's another story.
Renee, tell us about your experience when you finally realized what was happening, the war had ended. What started happening for you?
When the war ended, we all ran into the town square and danced around, and we were jubilant, and that was very short-lived because only my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, and my maternal aunt survived. So there was a rather huge hole in my family. There was really no future, seemingly. And though we had also lice, vermin, worms, I mean, I could never sit still because we were all crawling with stuff. We were very hungry, very cold. It was not a romantic Hollywood production. But after the war, there really was no food and things, no clothing, no shoes, no family.
Well, how did this change your relationship, or did it, with this family who you speak of so lovingly and who were so important to you? And then you suddenly realize that there is this hole that you describe. What does that do to the relationship with these
I wasn't
people?
Really given permission to think in terms of a whole, because if I asked my aunt and grandmother when my parents would be coming back, I was met with silence. And children are very bright and very tuned in to what is going on around, and I quickly felt that my questions were unwelcome, so I am ashamed to admit that I knew nothing and was not talking about the war and just lived life in a daily manner.
So, Sharon, I think that's the impetus behind this movement, is to make sure that the knowledge that has been assembled since is passed on so that we don't all forget. So what kinds of groups do you talk to, and what's the impact? I mean, I'm thinking about, I was born shortly after World War II and was acutely aware of what happened, but I noticed that when I talk to younger people, and it's not that they're ignorant, but it's the farther we get from this, the less impact it seems to have. What do people know about, the younger people know about what happened?
I have a feeling I can challenge you a little bit. I think they are ignorant. There's a wonderful video on YouTube called 94 Maidens. And if you watch it, you'll see a second generation woman who goes to various campuses in Pennsylvania. And she interviews students just asking really simple questions. Who was Hitler? When did the Holocaust take place? They are clueless. They seem to recall learning it somewhere throughout their schooling, but can't tell you one answer. So we've got a big job to do in our country, in North Carolina, and locally in Durham Chapel Hill, about educating our young people.
Peter, I wonder what that's like when you confront, you know, sort of younger people or anyone who seems not to know what happened.
Yeah. Well, it's been a wonderful experience, and we go to public and private schools in Orange County. You know, some of the students are are better prepared. So some students know, but too many don't. And I think it's really our job. We're trying to educate. And it seems to me it's not only important to know the dates of the Holocaust, but the why did it happen? And there's an increasing number of genocides today. If you open the paper, you could read about Sudan or Darfur or Syria. And I think what's important for us is to educate, help students think about the kinds of information they need. Because today's students are tomorrow's citizens, and they will have to vote, and they will have to make decisions, and they will have to allocate funds. Is the United States going to intervene, or are they not? There's so many contemporary issues that I think we can only understand by understanding history.
Renee, I know you've gotten responses. You've talked to a lot of people and gotten responses from some students who've heard you talk.
I would love to read you some single lines from a couple of letters, which gives you maybe a little bit of a feeling of the impact that we can have on students. Number one, I've been bullied a lot of times and haven't felt so good about it. Thank you for being here. That's one letter. Another, You're an inspiration to us young teenagers, and you helped us realize what we can do to help. And from another one, in its entirety, it's brief, so don't worry. Thank you for telling us about your life in World War II. When you think about 11 million people dying, it's sad, but not as sad as if you focus on one person's tragedy and loss. And one last one, if you will allow me. I was telling my mom and dad about you when we were eating dinner together, and they like what I was telling them.
Mm. They can teach their parents, which is also pretty exactly. Pretty effective stuff. And Peter, it seems to me that one of the important things, too, is that it's so easy to demonize these figures in history, people like Hitler, and to almost create a separate species for this kind of individual. But it was all of those, you know, sort of those good folk who were not Hitler, who were aiding and abetting, who allowed this to happen and who knew what was going on. And Renee, you had a great family. There were also collaborators turning in Jews in Holland and other places. So it's that kind of everydayness, what the ordinary, the banality of evil, that I think, is that an important part of your message?
Absolutely. And a couple of the letters that I won't read right now spoke about the students learning that the bystanders were the majority group, not the Nazis and not the victims. And our concern also is increased in denial of the Holocaust, questioning the numbers, questioning the facts. And it's a very slippery slope. And, unfortunately, and we're filming the Holocaust survivors and liberators in this area because it's important to have their stories on film, because the deniers are increasing in volume and numbers, and we need to be able to show students and others what the truth was.
Well, and certainly it is a well-documented episode in history, so while their voices may be getting louder, I don't know that they're getting any traction, or I'd hope not. I would hope not. But it is an important part of this project, but also the bystanders and how easy it is to marshal everyday people in support of, who would offer their military support in this project, the project of Nazism and genocide. And as you say, it's happening over and over again today. In 2014, we're still seeing this kind of thing where everyday people can be brought into the service of this rote evil. Let me ask you, Sharon, too, as the daughter of a survivor, that's a separate group of people, right? You find yourselves sort of having to organize as well. You have your own separate set of ideas about things.
Unfortunately, survivors are disappearing. Soon it'll be the responsibility of children of survivors to share their stories.
So tell me about your parents.
My parents were not in camps. They were running underground, actually in the woods. So my father was from Latvia, one of the Baltic states, and my mother was from Poland. They met during the war in Russia, and they married then. After the war, they were put into a displaced persons camp and then came to America after a journey across the sea. And they lived in New Haven, Connecticut, where there happened to be a large community of Holocaust survivors. So I grew up hearing their stories. It was commonplace for me to hear them over playing cards or a dinner. They would reminisce. So I grew up knowing the stories, not being afraid to ask questions. And as early as 1970s, I started organizing Yom HaShoah events, commemorations where we remember the Holocaust and the victims. It's a part of my life.
Well, Renee and Peter, I want to ask you both, and I'll start with you, Renee. What is the largest message that you want people to take away from your talks?
I very much address bullying because this is such an ever-present problem in all the schools. And you see what can happen when bullying is carried to an extreme. I mean, beyond an extreme. Mm-hmm. I would also like people to have awareness so that they can see danger signs, and very much telling school children to be upstanders and not to be bystanders. There's so many messages, right, and you can't get them all into a short piece.
No, but certainly with bullying, bystanders play an important part. The extent to which we allow this to happen, and even students on the school lot allow it to happen, is reinforces it all. Peter, what about you?
Well, I'd like to second Renee's thing. Action can occur at the individual level. People can stand up. Someone's getting beat up. Get involved. Find out what's going on. Try to establish a climate in the school that's more tolerant, that's more supportive, but also at the policy level. And that's why education is so important. For example, recently the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum identified more than 42,000 ghettos and concentration camps throughout Europe, the fantastic network. And so there's more and more to learn about the European Holocaust and about other genocides. And to be informed and educated, I think, is our important mission.
Peter Stein, along with Renee Fink, are both survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. Sharon Halperin is one of the organizers of the Chapel Hill Durham Holocaust Speakers Bureau. She is also the daughter of two Holocaust survivors. There's more of the State of Things just ahead. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and today we are sharing stories of people who survived the Holocaust. It is, in fact, Holocaust Remembrance Day. Sid Saknow remembers. He was born in Kaunas, Lithuania in 1934. At 7 years old, he was imprisoned at the Kovno concentration camp. He was there for 3 years before he escaped and was forced to live in hiding until the end of the war. But the end of the war didn't bring much relief. Life under Soviet rule brought new challenges. Eventually, when Sid was a teenager, his family was able to emigrate to the United States. There he attended school for the first time and later joined the U.S. Army, where he became a decorated major general. Sid Saknow is speaking at Elon University tonight at 7:30 in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day, and he joins us now. Welcome, Sid. Good to talk with you.
Good to be here.
What do you remember about your hometown of Kaunas in Lithuania before the German invasion?
Well, it was a lovely town. It has no industry, but it has rich soil, so it was primarily a farming community. It fed itself. We lived in harmony, which was something that we didn't fully appreciate at that time. I was born in Kaunas, which had 160,000 citizens, and 40,000 of those were Jews. So every fourth citizen in Kaunas was a Jew.
Mm.
And we were able to live and get along, and everything seemed to be going well.
Until the invasion, what do you remember of the German invasion?
We knew that the clouds of war were gathering, but it seemed like it was a long ways away. We were aware that Denmark, Norway, Netherlands, France, and Belgium were pretty much conquered by the Nazis. But it was far away. It was before cable, and news didn't travel that fast. But my parents were educated in Germany, and although they were familiar and heard about Mein Kampf, the book Adolf Hitler wrote, they said, it's totally out of character. I know the Germans. That's not them. And then one day, it did happen. We had an invasion, and things changed dramatically.
Thousands of Jews were killed in Kaunas, and not all by the Nazis. This must have you talked about. You talked about the fact that people had been living in harmony. Tell us what happened.
Actually, the Germans arrived as part of their strategic plan to invade the Soviet Union. And this was one of the biggest mistakes that Adolf Hitler made, because he opened up a second front before solidifying the Western Front. In June 24th, 1941, the Germans entered Kaunas. And during the first 30 days of occupation, 10,000 of the 40,000 Jews were brutally murdered. The irony in this all is that it was not done by the Germans. It was done by our neighbors and friends, fellow Lithuanians. And then, of course, we were given 30 days to gather up any belongings we could carry. And we were moved into a little village called Slobodka, which was just adjacent to Kaunas. It had about a capacity for maybe about 2,000-3,000 people. And when we were moved into the camp, we were close to 30,000. So it was kind of crowded, but we were optimistic, because a ghetto could give you a certain degree of freedom and safety. And we thought that would happen for us, but it didn't turn out that way.
You were about 7 years old at the time, right?
Right. My age is kind of flimsy because I don't have a birth certificate.
Mm. But you were young. You were a young boy at the time.
I was a young boy.
What was life like there? You referred to it as a ghetto, not quite a concentration camp. What was life like there?
Normally, when we think of concentration camp, we think of barracks, buildings symmetrically lined up, real organized. This was just an existing little village, a poor village, with shacks. I wouldn't even call them houses. Dirt street with some streets with cobblestone. And they just slapped a fence around it and a gate and put guards on it and said, that's where you're going to live and that's where you're going to work. And we started out with about 29,000 prisoners. And 3 years later, when the Russians liberated us, we were down to 2,000, which is an attrition rate of 95%.
Now, when you say us, you weren't there at the time. You were able to escape. Is that right?
3 months before the liberation, I escaped because my parents have heard that there'll be a children's aktion, that whatever children were available were going to be rounded up and moved to some other places, extermination camps, or killed right there in Kovno at Fort Nine. And my parents knew some people, and I was smuggled out of the camp, and I lived with them. I had to change families because I started suffering from malnutrition, and they were concerned that it may be contagious, and I was moved to another family. Now, these families took enormous risks in taking me in, but they were also compensated for it.
Compensated how?
In jewelry.
I see. And what was life like for you? Did you have to stay in hiding? How? What was everyday life like for you with those families?
Well, initially, the first family, I stayed in a room by myself, and it's lonesome. So I befriended bugs and spiders, and you just learn to entertain yourself. You do a lot of talking to yourself. And I was still a kid. I didn't fully understand everything.
You were, of course, not with the rest of your family. After the war, you were reunited. What was that like? Where did that happen?
Well, I was with the family still in hiding when the war ended. And one day, my mother shows up, and it was wonderful. The war was over. We were going to go get my brother, who she knew where my brother was. He was with a sea captain. My brother was younger, so he was a prime commodity because some families wanted children, but they didn't want somebody that had a good memory. They wanted somebody that's very young. And my brother was young, and he was taken in by this captain, sea captain. And we made our way, but it was a tough period because when the war ended, suffering did not end. And there was a real shortage of food. And the people that did farming normally had an advantage. People who lived in urban areas were at a disadvantage as far as food was concerned. And, of course, it didn't take very long for the black market to start operating. My mother and I walked. There was no transportation. It took several days. We arrived at the captain's house. He willingly gave up my brother, and we made our way back to the city.
Eventually, you had a 2,000-mile trek after you had to leave Lithuania during the Soviet occupation, right?
Yes, but this was a trip of hope and high expectations. I was going to where there was freedom, where there was safety.
Where were you going?
I was going to the western part of Germany, but occupied by the Americans. And our hope was that from there we would immigrate to the United States.
Which you did. And eventually you did get to the U.S. You started to learn English and attend school for the first time, am I right?
That's correct. Normally people think that assimilation is simple. Assimilation is very difficult. Well, you don't speak the language, you have never been to school, you have to make new friends, you have new customs, you try so desperately to fit in, but it's a process. It doesn't happen overnight. You just don't throw a switch and you're assimilated.
What was it like for you trying to make, you'd made so many transitions already, and you talked about the trip from Lithuania to Germany as one of hope, then to the U.S. How were you feeling at the time? Were you still hopeful? That's a lot of transition for a young man.
You know, by nature, I'm an eternal optimist. And I knew things couldn't get much worse than what they had been. So I was kind of upbeat about it. Discouraged at times, yes. But hopeful and I seen progress. The first year I went to school was a blank. I always had to start with basic. After you skip the first 7.5 years of education, that's a big hole. And so the first year I was just sitting there, not comprehending what was happening around me. But the city of Salem, Massachusetts, was very generous. They assigned a tutor. They worked with me. They helped me along in school. And I was never a good student, you know. I certainly wouldn't have had the credentials to go to any prestigious college. I just made it by the seat of my pants.
Well, you weren't the only one to make the transition, of course. Your father had to support a family. He told your family he had a job as an engineer, but really didn't. Tell us how you found out.
Well, that was a sad moment. And to this day, it is a sad moment. My father was a proud individual. He had an education, but it was not functional. He didn't speak the language. He was outdated. And he didn't have the credentials. So he was looking for a job, and it was not easy. He was not really marketable because of his language difficulties. And one day he came and he said that he had a job at a plastic factory, Pioneer Plastic. And we were delighted, but we all made an assumption. We made an assumption he's working in his trade, as an engineer. He never actually cleared that up for us. And one day, I was the only one in the family that was driving. I had a license. And it was pouring rain. And my mother said, go pick up your father, which is only about a couple miles away from where we lived. And so he won't get wet because it was not letting up. It was still raining hard. I went down there, I parked, and I was waiting for him to come out. And there was no way of communicating that I was out there. That's before cell phones. And after a while, he didn't come out. I went inside the building, and I asked somebody, do you know where Leon Shacknow is? And he said, pointed to the men's room. And I went to the men's room, and my father was mopping up the men's room. And I wasn't quite sure what to make of it for a moment. But my father turned around, and he seen me, and he felt horrible. We went out in the car. I started driving. It was dead silence. And I could just hear him crying, and I was crying, and we went home.
Did you ever talk about it after that?
No.
You decided to join the Army, and you did four tours in Germany. Talk about that. Talk about serving in the U.S. Army in Germany as an adult.
You know, there's a certain irony to it all. I served in Germany as an enlisted soldier. I served in Germany as a non-commissioned officer. I served in Germany as a general officer. When I served in Germany as a general officer, the irony of it all, it's a nemesis retribution. I was assigned as the commanding general of U.S. forces in Berlin, Germany, the capital that initiated all the problems. And Berlin, Germany was divided city into four sectors, a British sector, a French sector, an American sector, and a Russian sector. And I got to know all the commanders of the other sectors. And I befriended the commanding general of the Russian sector, General Dulenko. And one day he was over my house with his friend, and they were laughing, and I asked him, what's so funny? He says, there's an irony here. He says, here you are, a Jew who has been liberated by us, the Soviet Army, and here you are defending the very Germans that imprisoned you and are defending against us, the Soviet Union. And I said, you're right, there is an irony at all. Life is sometimes unpredictable.
You have many grandchildren now. How do you hope they'll grow up understanding their heritage and the Holocaust?
I encountered, as I grew older, some medical problems. I had a bout with cancer, I had a bypass heart surgery. And I think a reality set into my family and with myself about my mortality. And I was persuaded by my youngest daughter and my wife to put pen to paper and write the story of my life in something to leave it behind. The intent was to write and have it bound by Staples or Kinko's and make enough copies for the family. But there are some people that thought it had some redeeming qualities and would make a good book. And so I wrote a book, Hope and Honor. And it's, although it's a commercial book, I satisfied the requirement for the family. So my grandkids and my great-grandkids, we have 7 great-grandkids and 14 grandkids. They have something that long after I'm gone, they'll be able to leaf through the pages and say, that was our grandfather.
General Sacknow, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Good talking to you, Frank. Good day.
Sid Sacknow is a Holocaust survivor, a U.S. Army veteran, and the author of Hope and Honor. He's going to speak at Elon University tonight, 7:30, in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day. That's our program. Our website is stateofthings.org. Our producers are Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Mataferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf's our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.